you could see off in the horizon the flares going off. You could hear the artillery. And, you know, we were, you know, eating hamburgers and drinking cold beer. And we knew that, you know, 10 miles out in that direction, people were getting killed.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
6, 9, 8, 8, 3.
The withdrawal of American and all other foreign forces from Vietnam within a period of 60 days.
And I'm here to host this final program from the German Democratic Republic for you.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you subscribe in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. In this episode, we talk with Colonel Keith Nightingale, who served in the US military from 1965 to 1993. He completed two tours of Vietnam, the first as a senior advisor to a Vietnamese Ranger unit, and the second as a rifle company commander in the 101st Airborne. Keith used the experience of his first tour to write Just Another Day in Vietnam, which gives a vivid first-hand account of a jungle operation with the South Vietnamese Rangers against the Viet Cong. If you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Co-host James conducts our chat, and I am delighted to welcome Keith Nightingale to our Cold War conversation.
I grew up in Southern California. I went to what we call Reserve Officers Training Program and was commissioned in the regular Army on the 6th of June, 1965. At that time, Vietnam was just warming up, but it was clear anybody in the Army was going to go there. So I decided I wanted to go with the best we had. So I opted for both Airborne and Ranger School, went to both, and then had a stint in the 82nd Airborne before I deployed. I received orders to go to Vietnam as an advisor to a Vietnamese Ranger battalion, and I showed up in late April of 1967.
Why were you sent to Vietnam? Why were you told at that time that the war in Vietnam was happening?
Well, in retrospect, we all sort of drank the Kool-Aid. You may remember that at that point, the domino theory was a major strategic view from the Western worlds. If one of these Asian countries was taken over by the communists, the rest would soon follow. The actual real pressure, beginning with JFK, was in Laos. And then Vietnam was kind of an ancillary when we basically replaced the French in 1954 with the peace accord. We became the sponsor of what was South Vietnam. And, you know, we provided advisors and equipment and training and all that. And so this was just sort of a progression when the VC and the North Vietnamese began incursions into the South.
When you arrive in 1967 as an advisor, what is the state of the war at that stage?
Well, you have to understand, as a first lieutenant, never been in combat before. It was all both a great mystery and quite exotic. You know, to go from Southern California to, say, Saigon with all that exotica was, you know, quite a change. And I didn't know anything about the country, really, other than what I had read. It was very hot, very humid. It was a horrible flight going into Saigon. It was over 24 hours. And you didn't get any sleep, and they didn't have any real service. So you arrived, you were already somewhat whacked. Then the first thing I remember getting off the plane was the blinding sunlight, the heat and the humidity, and the kind of smell of rotting, burning garbage.
You paint a very vivid image.
Well, that's, you know, that's what it was. You don't know what you're getting into. We were processed, given our fatigues and boots, no weapons, basic, what we call TA-50, which is the wet gear and all your kit, and had 3 days of paperwork processing and all that. And as an officer, I was assigned a room in what was the Rex Hotel. And on top of it, it had the roof was a restaurant and a bar out in the open. And, you know, I sat there with the other troops that I was with. You could see off in the horizon the flares going off. You could hear the artillery. And, you know, we were, you know, eating hamburgers and drinking cold beer. And we knew that, you know, 10 miles out in that direction, people were getting killed. So it was somewhat of an exotic experience mentally at that point. I was then assigned to my unit, which was in Swan Lock, which is about 60 miles north and east of Saigon. Austere area, massive French rubber plantations, and quite a bit of dense jungle coming right up to the town. The Ranger unit that I joined, the 52nd Rangers, were on a hill just to the south of town in very austere quarters. I mean, in the case of our advisory team, we were in an old canvas tent that had more holes in it than not. Dirt. There was just, you know, no amenities at all. And that was my first introduction to the war at that point. And, you know, everything was kind of sensory overload in terms of absorbing things and figuring out what I was supposed to be doing.
What did the Rangers think of your arrival? I mean, you've never seen combat, and this unit presumably has seen quite a lot of combat.
Yes. The 52nd was highly decorated. It had been awarded an American Presidential Unit Citation for an action about a month previous. I have to, you know, kind of define the term of advisor. You know, the impression is, well, you're advising the Vietnamese on how to fight. That's totally erroneous. We didn't advise them on a fight at all. They knew much better than we did how to manage it. What we did is we brought all the American assets in, the tactical air, the artillery, the gunships, the helicopters, all of the kind of basic technology that the American Army had is what the advisor's job was to bring it to the Vietnamese in a coherent fashion. So we would meet with our counterparts. I was the junior deputy advisor. The executive officer was my counterpart. The senior advisor, Captain Shine, was the advisor to Major Hepp, the battalion commander. And our advising basically was figuring out what the maneuver plan was for the Vietnamese. And then we templated on top of that the American technology. as an untrained task, our primary job was what we call in the U.S. forward observers. We adjusted the artillery. We called in and adjusted the tactical airstrikes. We called in and managed the helicopter gunships. So we were more, call it artillery focused, than grunt infantry focused.
What were these Ranger units like? How do they compare to the U.S. Army and the more regular South Vietnamese Army?
Well, at that particular time, I didn't know. I had no reference points. It was quickly apparent they definitely knew their job. The Ranger Battalion and most all of the Ranger Battalions were composed with what you might call the dregs of Vietnamese society. The people that could not dodge the draft, could not get out of the war, did not have the money to get a cushy assignment. These were predominantly mountain hill tribe personnel, Nungs, Chams, and sort of the bottom rung of Vietnamese society. But they were extraordinary combat soldiers. They knew they were in that battalion for their life. There was not going to be any rotation home like there was with us. When they joined the battalion, they were essentially there for life, however long that would be. They were seriously undergunned at the time that I arrived. They were fighting predominantly with our World War II cast-offs, the M1 rifle, the 1917 machine gun. You know, they had nowhere near the firepower that our opposition VC had with the AK-47s and all. They did have two M60 machine guns, new, that was given to them by the 11th Cav as a result of a ambush that they cleared out, and which is why they won the presidential unit citation. They rescued an entire squadron of the 11th Cav, and the regimental commander came in and gave them two brand new machine guns, which, of course, they loved. Midway through my tour, we were issued for the first time the U.S. weaponry, the M16s and the M60s. And it made a huge difference in terms of their confidence, the troops' confidence, but it made no difference in terms of how they conducted themselves. They had a very karmic attitude. You know, we're in here, we're going to die, don't worry about it, whatever happens, happens. And after the battle that I describe in my book, I took on that kind of philosophy, and it was immensely helpful. You just quit worrying about stuff and just did your job. Seems very elemental, but it's not that easy to achieve. The U.S. units at the time, to answer your question, that I was associated with, the 1st Division, the 173rd Airborne, the 25th Infantry, the 11th Cav, they were superb professional units from top to bottom. They had come in from the States. They were virtually all volunteers, very solid NCO and officer corps, and the soldiers wanted to be there. It was dramatically different on my second tour for obvious reasons.
What was it like when you finally move into the field and you know that you're going to face combat for the first time in an environment, a physical environment that is very different to certainly the US? How did you feel?
I don't think you really feel anything. You're just incredibly curious. The very first operation I went on was in a place called the Rungsat Zone, which is a swampy mangrove area south of Saigon. And we were all in these little wooden boats, and they would move us around in various parts and pieces to this incredible maze of ground, because that's what the VC used for their hidden transport and caches and communications. So we were out there to disrupt it. Well, I had no idea what we're doing, and I'm just in a boat with 20 other people following along. And, you know, we get off in the boat, we clear through the jungly, swampy area, nothing much here. So we get on the boat and go back to the next location, and so on and so forth. Well, suddenly we had a lot of action, wham, bam, boom. And, you know, my eyes are open. What's going on here? And I run forward, you know, curiosity kills the cat. I ran forward to see what was going on, because it was very close terrain. You couldn't see more than about 20 meters. And, you know, I saw these three rangers down on the ground pumping rounds into the bush. I brought up my weapon and, you know, added to the fire. And all of a sudden, this guy came running out behind the bush and over a hill. And I just made a snap shot, bam, pure deer hunter instinct, if you would. And, you know, we moved forward to clear the ground. And on the other side of the hill, there was this body. And, you know, the rangers pointed it out to me. And so I went down, the first time I'd ever fired my weapon in combat, and the first dead VC I'd ever seen. And I have to tell you, I just was curious. There was zero emotion associated with it. It was just like I was hunting deer. I know that's kind of hard, but that's just how mentally and emotionally I think a soldier has to deal with this sort of stuff.
So it's like a coping mechanism in a way, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. If you actually thought about it, it'd drive you crazy. You know, that's why the, you know, PTSD and the suicide stats go up.
Let's talk about your book, because as you were saying earlier, before we had this conversation, that I have to curse you for your book, because it kept me awake to the early hours on a number of occasions. But it is a fantastic book, Just Another Day in Vietnam. And Cold War Conversations has some copies to give away, details on that to follow. But Keith, tell us, what prompted you to write the book?
I never went into, call it the writing, I never had a disciplined picture that I'm going to write a book now. Wasn't that way at all. I had taken notes of particular impressions or issues in a little notebook I had throughout my tour. And, you know, I just, you know, I would see something, a firefly, a lizard, a particular action, a personality, the effect of the jungle on people and things, you know, whatever my kind of snapshot impressions were. And I just wrote it down without any discipline or organization. And then I came back and was assigned to an ROTC assignment as a teacher between my Vietnam tours. And one weekend it just hit me, wham, I got to write this down. I mean, I saw the notebook and that's what triggered it. And I was, of course, busy Monday through Friday with classes and all that. So I would just come home on the weekend, and as kind of a cathartic action, I just write. The book itself has almost no editing, and it had no changing structure. What you see in the book is exactly what I was thinking at the moment I wrote it. Didn't help me much with my wife and child, who is, you know, both anxious to know me over the weekend. But it was something I was really truly compelled to do, you know, whatever was inside me just kind of burst out like a fire hose on that. And, you know, in terms of the actual content, you know, I would see a trigger note like rubber plantation, and I would just close my eyes and I would see it. And then that's what I would write. The same as the, you know, the airstrike that would go in, I could just close my eyes and it was just like a movie film in front of me. And that's what I would just write. So, what you read is what I saw. And that was basically it. It took me 2 weekends. And as I said, I did very little in the way of editing. And when I gave it to the publisher, they looked at it and said, well, it's basically print ready. And they made very little changes. So, you know, what you get is the end of my literary fire hose, if you would.
So one thing I found very interesting about the book is that it's not a unit history. It's not a one-sided view of a particular action or campaign. It does paint the story of both what the Rangers were thinking and the South Vietnamese forces were thinking and the North Vietnamese forces and the VC were thinking. How were you able to get both sides of the story and know that they were based on fact and not supposition?
Well, as we say, as I said in the introduction, this is basically a hybrid. It's a combination of hard facts and then conjecture, or what I would call factoids, based on conversations with a number of people. And this is kind of the unique thing about the book. I made a conscious decision that I would write the book in the third person so that it was not a, you know, wham, bam, Vietnam book about, you know, how wonderful I was. It was much larger. But in order to paint that picture, I had to take on sort of a third person. And that was the vehicle I used to describe the other side, if you would. The unique thing about this is that as a result of our action and basic destruction, we had a number of prisoners, Rangers, taken prisoner by the VC. And they were released back to us, eight of them were, in December. The action took place in June. The prisoners were released back to us as a, quote, humanitarian gesture, unquote, in December. And I was then the senior advisor. And the battalion commander, Major Hepp, who is basically the star of the whole thing, interviewed them with me, debriefed them. You know, where were you? What happened to you? Blah, blah, blah. Well, he was very suspicious of them, that he felt they were essentially flipped VC. So he was quite intense in his interrogation and pointed. And his system was that he would interview each one independently and keep each one separated from the other eight after the interview. Well, what came out was very consistent with all eight people. They said that they were told by the VC leadership in their POW camp, which was just about a couple kilometers from the battle site. This thing was all a planned ambush at the highest level, and that the POW camp was actually co-located with what was called COSVN headquarters, Central Office of South Vietnam. In other words, the tactical field manager of the VCNVA, General Nguyen Chi Tan. And two of the prisoners said that they personally talked to Tan, and he came out, wandered around the cages, and just talked to them. as did some other leaders, you know, up and down the VCNVA chain. And they came all, but they all came back with the same story.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
This was a brand new strategy by Tan to destroy elite Vietnamese units, to destroy the Vietnamese morale, if you would, and reduce the effective forces that the South had, understanding that the elite were the Rangers, the Airborne, and the Marines. Everybody else was of so-so quality, with few exceptions. So they targeted a Ranger battalion. And they knew that because of the situation where we were, that the Rangers would be tasked for the job. And they picked a place beyond normal U.S. Support capability, read artillery. And they developed a whole deception story, as I indicate, with Mr. Hu, who said, "Hey, we have a company size base camp I've just escaped from, and you know, it's up here," and he showed it on the map, and he had a pretty good understanding of reading maps. And of course it ended up being a regiment plus, in that company size base camp. And the whole point of the operation was to destroy the Ranger battalion and then go on to other ones. And the prisoners talked about how the VC told them about the ambush of the CAV coming to rescue us to the south. They knew that there was only one location where the CAV could cross this stream, and they totally prepared it for the ambush, which was successful, stopping them. And then there was a B-52 strike against the prisoner, the POW camp. And I described that at some length because that was obviously a major impression on the prisoners. Because of their status as POWs, they were well off to the side of the camp and therefore were essentially unfazed by the attack, even though the main group was completely wiped out. And reportedly, Tan was also killed there. And they talked about having to go in this long trek back into Laos with Tan's body. And then there they were met by a Alouette helicopter, which picked up his body and flew it back to Hanoi. If you look at the history, you'll see that the NVA said that Tan died of a heart attack in Hanoi. The date is coincidental with our action, so we gave it a degree of credibility. Is it all true? Don't know. Do I believe it to be true? Absolutely. There were just too many parts that worked for me not to believe that, you know, they were designing a clock, if you were.
There is one bit in the book, which I read twice, which is where The Ranger Battalion has made its first foray. It's been pushed back by the VC. It's then been surrounded with a very small ellipsical perimeter. The armored cav have come in and got stuck in the river in a clan trap by the North Vietnamese sappers. And then you start to wonder at this point if it is not hopeless for the South Vietnamese Rangers, and indeed yourself as the third party sort of narrator. I mean, you play a very small part in the book. What did it feel like for you at that moment when it seems that all hope is lost other than a spotter pilot above you in a small aircraft?
Well, actually, you kind of put your mind in neutral and you just deal with that very small microcosm in front of your rifle sight. My partner, Sergeant Swires, and I were engaging enemy all night. And it became a very kind of rote routine. You'd see this shadow come at you and you'd shoot him and you wouldn't see the shadow anymore. But we knew that, you know, just by the volume of fire that was going on, you know, that we were in trouble. I had communication with the FAC up above the L-19 spotter plane. And so I could monitor what was going on with Captain Shine, who was about 100 yards away from me on my left, as well as what the spotter plane was saying about what was going on in the rest of the world to help us out. We heard all of the fire with the cab down south, and we knew the cab was coming to get us. And then, you know, we got the report, hey, you know, they've been ambushed and they can't make it. You know, you're basically on your own. At that point, as you indicate, we were in a compressed perimeter. We had taken about three quarters of the base camp with the initial assault. And then they just ran constant human wave attacks against us. And we were pushed back and back and back to where we were in the last position in the base camp. And at that point, Major Hep called us in and he said, you know, this is desperate. We're going to have to do something or we're going to be annihilated. Captain Shine had arranged for all the tactical air in the Third Corps area to be stacked up in our support. We were the number one priority in Saigon for support. And so all of the tactical air, the naval aircraft carriers offshore, the Air Force aircraft at Tan Sanhut and several other locations, Benoit, we're all programmed for us. This is going on now, the conversation we're having with HEP, about 5:30, quarter to six in the morning, just starting to get a little bit of light under the canopy. And HEP just outlined the plan. He said when the first aircraft come on station, Captain Shine will bring them in, and with their very first load that they're going to drop, second company, which was holding the center of our line, Lieutenant Tang, would rise up and assault into the VC line. This would provide a momentary distraction and relief and allow us to start moving out through the bomb line. And Shine's plan was quite simple. First plane comes in and drops its load. Second plane comes in and drops it just in front of that, and so on and so forth. And we just follow the crater line out, knowing that there's not going to be anybody alive where the bombs blow up. Our job was to figure out how to get on the other side of the bomb line so we didn't get cleaned out too. Well, consider this mentality. Tan has got about 30 people left in his company of what should have been about 120. And you know, he was going to pick up what he had and assault into the VC line, knowing full well that was a suicide move, but that was what was needed to save the rest of the unit. So that gives you an idea as to the Ranger mentality and quality. And, you know, I was over with Shine and Hep when they described this thing to me, and basically I wasn't given any instructions. I was just told what was going to happen and, you know, follow, you know, the line as best we could. And that's what it was. Beginning at 6:30 in the morning, the helicopter gunships came in, which I adjusted. And, you know, they were marginally effective. You know, it was deep jungle. The aviators could really not see us at all. They could just see smoke, and, you know, we would give them guidance by sound. And then about 6:45, the first aircraft came in, and I remember it vividly because there was a small opening in the canopy. And I can close my eyes today and see the airspace between the wing and the bombs that he had. And these big air brakes come popping out right over my head. And I'm thinking, oh, expletive. You know, it's all over. And then there was this huge double blast, ba-woom, ba-woom. And, you know, we were just rained with wood, leaves, mud, the whole thing. And, you know, we weren't hit, though. You know, that really woke me up. You know, I thought I was done for. And, you know, the bombs went off and we were rained on this thing, and the L-19 pilot said, "Holy shit, there they are." And the bombs had just providentially landed on virtually an entire battalion of VC that were on our flank. And if they had attacked, we'd have been done. They were like within 50 meters of me. And we had no force capable of holding that thing back. Well, the two bombs, which I guess were 1,000-pounders from the Canberra, just obliterated them. And at that point, it was just a continuous rain of tactical air. You know, the planes had, you know, come in very close, dump, ba-woom, and we'd run to the next crater. And, you know, we did that for the rest of the morning and eventually got back to where we had started, where the helicopters had dropped us originally the previous day. I was carrying a wounded guy. Swires had another wounded guy. We got into this perimeter that we had created basically with what we had left. Shine and Hep were talking, and Shine looked at me and he said, you know, find out how many people we got. And so I went around the perimeter and I came back and I said, counting us, we got 32 people. That was from the 450 that we started with. So you get an idea on the intensity. Eventually, troops, you know, filtered back. We ended up with about 175 total of the original 450.
One chapter that really does strike me is the one that describes the B-52 arc light mission from Japan. Because on the one hand, that seems very surgical, these guys getting into their planes in a, you know, a very safe environment. On the other hand, the destruction that such a capability brings must have been a real game changer for you in that situation.
Well, yeah, I actually remember that strike quite well. We were still at that landing zone that we'd started at. And this was the following night, probably around 1800 in the evening. And we didn't know it was going in. We had no idea. And, you know, you never hear these planes because they're flying so high. And all of a sudden, we could just hear crump, 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 crump coming through the jungle. And then the ground literally started to wave like an ocean. And I was actually knocked to the ground. I could not stand up from the continuous kind of ripple effect in the organic layer of the jungle. You know, later on during the course, we went in and we did what's called BDAs, bomb damage assessment, post-strike. And so what the Ranger prisoners described to me was very much in sync with my own experience. I just, in the book, just describe what the Rangers told me. And I found it very consistent with my own experiences later.
Tell me more about Major Yep. He sounds like a very interesting character.
Oh, he's extraordinary. I consider him probably the greatest professional teacher, leader, commander of my experience. He was born in North Vietnam. That time it was Indochina. His father was basically a village bureaucrat for the French. And as a boy, he was hauled out of his house and forced to watch the Viet Minh shoot his father in the town square because of his association with the French. When the French departed in 1954, his aunt took him, his mother had already died. His aunt took him south, where he settled into the Saigon area. And as soon as he was eligible, he went to the Da Lat Military Academy, their West Point, and was in the French paratroopers. And then when the French departed, he was just segued into the Ranger battalions. Extraordinary human being, absolutely hated the VCNVA. His whole life was dedicated to killing them, large part based on his experience with his father. But he was extremely professional and really smart, and always thought out of the box. More importantly, from my view, he never succumbed to the greed and venality and the politics that abounded in the Vietnamese army. In fact, just the opposite. And because of that, the senior leadership disliked him because they couldn't trust him. And you know, they didn't give him any breaks at all professionally. But, you know, life is luck and timing. And things happened that propelled him. On the first one, he was the executive officer in a Ranger battalion when Dong Xoai Special Forces Camp was overrun. And both the U.S. and the Vietnamese were anxious, extremely concerned about rescuing the Americans inside the Special Forces camp. The only force available was his Ranger battalion. The battalion commander was drunk in Saigon, and so Hep ended up being the Ranger battalion commander for this assault. And both the Americans and the Vietnamese wanted him to land at a particular location about a mile or so away from the camp and move into it. Hep said, absolutely not. They know we're going to land there. We'll get ambushed. We'll never make it. I insist that we land on the camp. After a lot of conversation, Hep got his way. They landed on the camp. And he extracted personally Lieutenant Williams, who won a Medal of Honor for his actions there. And in the post-operation, it was determined he was absolutely correct. that they had an ambush prepared at that location for the Rangers if they were to come in. So at that point, you know, he got he was promoted from lieutenant to captain because the U.S. insisted, actually. And then later, the battalion commander was absent again for whatever reason, and Hep ended up as now as a captain commanding the battalion in an ambush that the CAV had fallen into, their second squadron. And again, Hep said, "We're landing right on top of the enemy." Well, this left both the U.S. and the Vietnamese senior leadership aghast, and he insisted they landed right on top of the VC, which was a brilliant idea. They broke up the attack completely, and they were awarded a U.S. presidential unit citation for it. And at that point, he was basically forced into command of the 52nd Rangers. And I am forever grateful he was. He was extraordinary in the sense that he always tried to educate you. He knew that, you know, we were going back to the States and we had a career outside of Vietnam, and he wanted to make sure that we actually knew how to do the job. He would sit me down and say, "Okay, this is what we're doing, and this is what the VC are going to do, and then that's what I'm going to do." And then in the middle of the action itself, you know, bullets going off, bombs sailing, he'd say, "Okay, this is what's happening. This is what we're doing. This is what they're going to do. This is what I'm going to do." You know, in his kind of broken English, bam, bam, bam. And he was exactly correct. It was the greatest professional education I ever had. And I used it extensively on my second tour because of all the smarts he had given me about so many different things and how to fight this enemy and how the other side fought and operated. He later became a Ranger group commander and refused to surrender at the fall of Vietnam. He was finally captured, put into a re-education camp, as they said. And then he was so difficult and so unwilling to accede to any of the North's political correctness, a guard killed him. Outright. His wife and two children managed to escape to the U.S., and they've settled in Baltimore. But I consider him one of my kind of military lodestones and probably the greatest single professional military mentor of my life.
And there was one very telling episode after the main action where helicopters are going out looking for survivors, and they come across one in the middle of nowhere.
Yes. We knew that a number of troops had become displaced during the course of the action and scattered and basically just tried to escape the VC. And so for the next week, the 11th CAV began a series of overflights in the whole kind of vast war zone D area where our Rangers logically might get to, looking at every open space where, you know, they might be attracted to helicopters coming overhead. About, I'm going to say, memory escapes me, but about 5 days after this action, a flight team from the 11th CAV, and this was a gunship and a slick, an unarmed helicopter, were flying over, and the door gunner spotted this guy standing in an open field down below. And he was just standing there waving at the helicopter. Well, of course, this got everybody's attention. And they wanted to check it and make sure it wasn't an ambush of some kind and what the deal was. So they did a low pass over it just to check him out. And they could see him standing there with something on his shoulder, but he was stock still and just waving at them. They looked at and they decided it was probably one of the Rangers. So the helicopter gunship came in very low and did a hover, looking directly at the guy. And then the slick came in and landed, and the door gunner went out and grabbed the guy and brought him into the helicopter. Well, big surprise. This was one of the Ranger NCOs, and he had over his left shoulder a wounded friend, buddy of his. And on his right shoulder, he had both of their rifles and their equipment, their full kit. Both of them were barefoot. And the door gunner helped them get on the aircraft with a wounded guy. They picked up and took off. And at that point, the door gunner saw that the sergeant had a sucking chest wound and just compressed it. I mean, there was blood and all on the shirt. The NCO asked for a cigarette, which the door gunner gave him. And as he breathed in, the door gunner could see the smoke trickling through his fatigue shirt where the penetration had taken place. And I always consider that the absolute epitome of what a Ranger is all about, U.S. or Vietnamese. It was just, I thought, an extraordinary thing. This guy had been in the jungle, wounded for 5 days, still had all of their equipment, and still had the presence of mind to manage it with his wounded buddy and rejoin us. One of the pictures in the book is the standard bearer for the Rangers at an award ceremony for this action. And that is the NCO was recovered.
My guess is that because these people can't circulate back to the US, you know, they are fighting in their backyard. It is going to be a very visceral fight, in a way that it perhaps wasn't for the American armed forces.
No quarter. You know, they had standards of management, if you would. The VC consistently shot all wounded. The NVA did not. The NVA would take prisoners. As a result, if we found a wounded VC, we, the U.S., had to grab him immediately to prevent him from being killed. And we'd make sure he got, you know, was patched up and went on the helicopter. If it was captured by an officer, the guy was safe. It was captured by a junior enlisted, probably not. And that worked the same way on both sides. Which made it a very personal war, and understanding that the war was fought around the families consistently, so that families were very often the victims of the action itself. And like I said, you know, it made it a very personal thing.
Now, you mentioned that you cycle back to the U.S. after your exciting first tour, and that you go and instruct at the ROTC. In the year that you've been away, how has public attitudes towards the war changed, and what did that make you feel?
Well, it had changed dramatically. When I went to Vietnam, 1967, the country was very supportive. You know, it was support the troops, support the war, et cetera. When I came back, it was totally the opposite. We had had all of the, you know, draft dodger card burnings, demonstrations in the street, This was post-Tet. This was May of 1968 that I came back. And the hate and invective that people had was directed at the soldiers, which I could never understand. You know, I'd seen what the soldiers did and how they did it, and it was totally honorable. It wasn't their fault that the war was going the way it was. That was something at the senior leadership in terms of policy and programs. The troops gave 100% all the time. Yet when you got back, you know, you were accused of being a baby killer, and they'd spit on you and, you know, unload all of their hate and invective personally on any returning soldier. And I just found that incredibly hateful and, you know, disgusting.
So when it comes time for your second tour, how do you feel about going back to Vietnam, given your previous experiences and also given what is going on in the country at the time?
Well, you know, I was at that point, I was a professional officer. And, you know, I basically wanted to go back to command U.S. troops. You know, my first tour, I was an advisor. I wanted to command U.S. troops in combat. You know, from just a rewards viewpoint, I wanted to do it, but it was also professionally necessary. So, you know, I went back assigned to the 101st in what was I Corps up in the north. Very different country than where I was in III Corps in the south. And the nature of the war and the nature of the leadership on the U.S. side had changed dramatically. You know, I wasn't associated with Vietnamese troops other than peripherally. The U.S., I was in a U.S. unit, and we were still sort of fighting the war, but it was very clear it was now a very risk-adverse, hunker down, don't embarrass anybody, we'll just get by, you know, for our tour and move on. A very, very different environment. I was still fired up by Hep and his experience. I wanted to go out and kill VC and NVA. And, you know, my senior leadership was a little leery about that.
And I guess that is why when on your second tour, there is Operation Lam Song 719, the Vietnamization of the war. And it was Vietnam that was invading Laos and not the U.S.
That was the idea. The overarching strategy was that the South Vietnamese could exhibit how competent they had become, and they could render major damage to the North and sustain themselves, which provided a fig leaf for further U.S. withdrawals. The problem was that the North Vietnamese were much more highly reactive than the South had the capability to manage. No U.S. forces were allowed to be in Laos. The whole idea of the plan was to attack to a place called Chipon, which was about 30 miles inland from the border. And this was the heart of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the big supply network that they had. The idea was the South Vietnamese would get into Chipon, capture all this stuff, blow it up, and make life very difficult for the North, and then, you know, pull back. Well, the problem was that the North was much more organized for response than we had anticipated. They immediately sent in three full divisions of forces with tanks and with armor and artillery, my company was assigned to secure a pickup zone at a place called Laobao, PZ1, which is on the exact edge of the border, overlooking Laos and along the principal conduit from Quezon into Chipon, Highway 5. Independent company operation, just secure it. Nobody expected any kind of ground issue. We were there more for window dressing and security than anything else. Well, within the second day, we started getting 122 artillery at us, and we could actually see the gun shooting at us by little winks on the hills just inland about 5 miles. And a 122 is a gun, which means it was like the German 88 in World War II, very fast. It's not a howitzer. It's crack bang. You have no time between when you get the first impression and when the round goes off. So we very quickly became troglodytes underground. It was very emotional for me because the primary assault force were Rangers. And I was in the TOC, the operations center, during all of this incursion and then the subsequent retreats. And the North had just brought in a tremendous amount of AAA because they knew that the only support the Vietnamese had, the Rangers and the Airborne had, were U.S. helicopters. Well, if the helicopters can't fly, they got no support, which is exactly what happened. Within a very short period of time, helicopters below 5,000 feet were basically blown out of the sky. And Laobao, where I was, just became this vast boneyard of U.S. helicopters. And we saw the Rangers coming back in bits and drabs off of a bird that might luckily get in, and guys hanging on the skids and then not hanging on the skids. So it was a very kind of difficult emotional point for me.
When you cycle out of Vietnam for the last time, what are your feelings of your overall experience in the country? Two quite different experiences, but are you glad to leave, or do you feel that you still have work to be done?
No, it's very. I had very conflicted feelings. The first is I was definitely glad I had the experience. As a professional infantry officer, I had been in combat. I had done reasonably well. And I saw how stuff worked. I developed a sense of, call it, military priorities with the troops. What's important, what's not important, that sort of thing. I was extremely disappointed with our senior leadership. The Army was in disarray. It had no discipline. The senior officers were afraid to exercise, call it, basic order and discipline. We had the race issues. We had major drug problems. That was very, very bothersome to me. But I never regretted my service over there. And I really loved the Vietnamese. I really got to admire them considering what they had to deal with for their entire lifespan, if you would. Just as an aside, when I went back to Vietnam in 2012 with my neighbor who I grew up with, was also in Vietnam. In the South, it was like we won the war. People were optimistic. They had a great attitude. They were entrepreneurial. They couldn't thank us enough for having been in Vietnam and what we meant to them. Et cetera, et cetera. It was kind of a huge shock. I went into this communist country, and thought I was in some microcosm of the U.S. Because you would never thought we had lost the war, with the people, you know, that would come up just voluntarily and say, oh, you Waukee, you Americans, said, yes, you know, Vietnam advice. And they'd, you know, pat me on the head, or they'd shake my hand, or they'd give me one of their, you know, thank you nods. So it was that's a long answer to your question. But the basic answer is I was very satisfied with my service. I was very dissatisfied with my leadership.
And back at home, how did you adjust personally and professionally to life back in the United States?
Well, it was difficult. The Army was struggling, didn't know what to do or how to do it. you know, by this time, I had had a second child, so we, you know, we had to deal with that. I was fortunate in that I came back with a 173rd Airborne, was on jump status. So we had, you know, high quality people, both officers and NCOs. The rest of the organization outside was not that way. And then Abrams at that point, 1974, established the first Ranger Battalion, the modern day Rangers. And one of the battalion commanders, Casey Luhr, who was in the 101st with me, was nominated to be the battalion commander of 175. And I joined him as one of his company commanders at Fort Benning, Georgia, later Fort Stewart. And we had the pick of everybody. It was basically the NCOs that wanted to be in the Army and wanted to resurrect the standards and professionalism that we had. And then we had the pick of whatever soldiers we could get that wanted to do it. So I was sort of in a bubble compared to the rest of the Army, and I'm very glad I was. I don't know how I would have reacted if I had been in a unit of lax standards and no interest in changing them. It was a much greater challenge for a lot of officers and NCOs that were in these units than for me. I consider myself very fortunate.
And how long do you think that the legacy of the Vietnam War affected the U.S. military and particularly the U.S. Army?
Well, I think it's still there in various bits and pieces. You know, the first is, which we've apparently squandered, is you don't go to war unless you're prepared to win or you have an exit strategy, neither of which existed in Vietnam. You know, Vietnam was the first, call it, disgrace of the U.S. military, something we've had to deal with ever since. It taught us, though, the basics of how to fight post-Korea World War II, which was very conventional. A lot of the tactics and techniques that we learned in Vietnam, the helicopter coordination, combined arms, et cetera, have held us in good stead up to this point. Vietnam is ancient history. People kind of understand the name. They don't really understand what it means. You know, sort of like everything else, it'll probably be lost in time, but it'll have several threads that will continue, even if they're not identifiable to that point. You know, in my own case, the whole time I was in the service, I vowed I was not going to be like my battalion and brigade commander in Vietnam. And, you know, you take on tough tasks, you tell them it's tough, you hold them to standards, and, you know, you insist that they achieve those standards or they move on. And, you know, I think that principle plus the growth of the Ranger Regiment, and more importantly, the Special Operations Forces, has, you know, that was all been underwritten by what we did in Vietnam.
Now, we have, as I mentioned before, 4 copies of your book to give away. Thank you very much. And more details on that will be in the show notes about how you can win a copy. But on behalf of Cold War Conversations, Keith, I have to say thank you very much indeed for the time you spent with us today.
I'm very glad to do it. Vietnam has a lot of things I think are of value today. And I'm just sort of the messenger of some of them. If anybody gets something out of the book that is positive, I'll consider that a good day on my part.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Thanks again to all our financial supporters of the podcast, but a special thanks to our Politburo level Patreons, who are Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, and Jeffrey Jones, who are supporting us at $30 per month. Thank you. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.